Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to International Horizons, a podcast of the Ralph Bunche Institute for International Studies at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. The podcast is meant to bring scholarly expertise to bear on our understanding of a wide range of issues. I'm Ellen Chesler, a senior fellow at RBI, having spent a long career in academia, government, and philanthropy. I'm sitting in today for John Torpy. Today, as we tape, is March 8th, 2024, International Women's Day. And I'm pleased and privileged to celebrate this occasion by interviewing Manu Bhagavan, a most distinguished professor of history at Hunter College and the CUNY Graduate Center, the author or editor of 8 books. We'll be talking about his latest, a rigorously researched and captivating new biography of Vijaya Lakshmi Pandit, which uncovers her major role in the movement for Indian independence and on a global stage in the years after World War II thereafter. Nan, as she was affectionately known, was the brilliant, charming, and outspoken sister of Prime Minister Nehru, and a celebrated diplomat and public official in her own right in the years after World War II, when she represented her country in the U.S., in the Soviet Union, and in Britain, and became the first woman to serve as president of the U.N. General Assembly. She was a pioneer for women's rights in that forum and elsewhere, for global institutions and consciousness, and for much more. As Gloria Steinem says in an affectionate blurb for the book, it's high time we met Nan Pandit. And no wonder the book is already, I gather, a bestseller on the subcontinent. Welcome, Manu, and thanks for being here today. To start, I will ask you simply to tell our audience a bit more about VLP and why she is so important, and perhaps most importantly, why she is worthy of our attention today.
Well, thank you, Ellen, and it's really my pleasure to be here. Thank you to International Horizons for having me. So I am, in fact, really honored to be able to speak about Madam Vijayalakshmi Pandit on International Women's Day to answer why people in the United States or anywhere in the world should care about her or who she was. First, let me just tell you a few things about the positions that she held. And in those will be reflected the pioneering nature of her work. She was, for instance, the first woman cabinet minister in India and the first in the British Empire to hold serious portfolios. She was also elected the president of the All India Women's Conference. She campaigned against British colonialism with Mahatma Gandhi. She was the first ambassador of India to the Soviet Union. She was the first woman ambassador to the United States. She was India's first ambassador to the United Nations, and she was the first woman president of the UN General Assembly. She held a series of other positions as well. These are a list of titles that doesn't really tell us who she was. So let me just give you a very brief set of examples that helps to illustrate this. One of the ways I like to think about her is that she was someone who did everything everywhere all at once, if I can borrow from a famous movie of that title. So just to illustrate this point, for instance, she was someone who from a very young age was quite close to members of the British aristocracy. She went to prison several times for her anti-colonial work, and yet very quickly she got involved with global affairs. For instance, she was detained by the police for the attempted assassination of Mussolini in the 1920s. She stayed next door to Lord Runciman, Britain's lead negotiator in Czechoslovakia during the Sudeten crisis. She stood outside 10 Downing Street when Chamberlain declared peace for our time. To headlines, she bashed appeasement and warned of the dangers of fascism in Britain the day before Winston Churchill made his famous remarks to Parliament. And that's all just at that one particular moment. She worked with Margaret Sanger, Alexander Kollontai, Golda Meir, and Madam Chang at various times. She just kind of ran the gambit. She sort of knew everyone, worked with everyone. W.E.B. Du Bois heralded her as the leader of the successful assault against the color line. At one point, when Joseph McCarthy was leaning in on his version of the Red Scare, she showed up to support Dorothy Kenyon when the judge was targeted. Dorothy Kenyon, of course, an inspiration for Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Marlon Brando named her the woman he admired most in the world. Robert Oppenheimer asked for her assistance in preventing nuclear disaster. She told Kennedy not to go to Dallas. The list just goes on and on. So in a nutshell, she was an extraordinary woman.
I'll say, and it's all engagingly, these stories are told in the book. But let me ask you to dig down a little bit more deeply into her personal biography. And unpack some of the things you've said. I can't begin to cover all of them, but I love your description of the childhood of the neighbors, which had Downton Abbey-like circumstances. Tell us a little bit about the world from which she came and how transformed she became by her relationship with her brother and then, of course, with Mahatma Gandhi.
Right. So Downton Abbey is the best way I can capture the kind of glittering mansion and estate on which she grew. Her father was an eminent lawyer in India whose clients were amongst the most privileged in the country. And he wound up making a lot of money. But it wasn't just that he made a lot of money. There were, in fact, people who were wealthier than him. But he had a gregarious personality. He just sort of filled up any room he went into. And he had good taste, I suppose, is a way to put it. So he spent rather lavishly, but not ostentatiously. The home he bought was called On in the Bhavan. In the city of Allahabad. It means the abode of joy.
I love that name.
Yeah, and it had both a Western and an Eastern wing, and that really helps to symbolize the way Nan, as Vijayalakshmi Pandit was known to all who were close to her, had a foot in both worlds. She grew up in India, but also was very familiar with Western traditions,
educated by a British nanny, right?
Yes. And so she grew up in these surroundings and was doted on. She was a loved child. She was precocious, but her parents...
Well, also beautiful. I think we can say that. I mean, it's an important dimension of who she was her good looks, right?
She was very good looking, yes, right from a young age and sort of grew into her beauty as she got older. But her brother, her parents sort of, you know, thought about her brother's education, her elder brother by 11 years, Jawaharlal Nehru. And he wound up going to Harrow and Trinity College in England. While Nan was very smart, her parents did not think about her education in the same way. It was unusual to think about girls' education in general, and even though the family sort of broke norms, they didn't sort of break that too much. At the same time, they did hire private tutors. This was considered the elitist of elite education, and they did train her up to a certain point. So she did receive elite tutored education as a young child, but not to a very advanced stage.
A bit about how the father's and son, Nehru, and daughter became so close to Gandhi and so central to the movement for independence, given this very elite and rather Western education and background?
Well, it's from the perspective of Nan, it's a bit of a funny story. Gandhi comes back and gets more involved in the Indian subcontinent in the late 19-teens, comes back from South Africa. By this point, Motilal Nehru, that's Nan's father, had been involved with the Indian National Congress. He was very moderate and, generally speaking, an Anglophile. her brother was a bit more radical and was pushing for different kinds of changes when he'd come back from his study at Trinity.
Also Cambridge. Enormously handsome. Until I read your book, I had no idea how good looking. I don't want to be gendered in our discussion of looks. So but Neighbor was also an extremely distinguished and handsome man.
Smashingly handsome is the way he was frequently described. But, dashing good look, certainly. Yes. So that was the general tenor of things. Gandhi sort of came back and grew in influence with the family. Their family mansion, Anand Bhavan, was the center of a lot of political activity because of Motilal's personality, his connections, his wealth, and his participation in the Congress. And so Gandhi sort of grows closer and grows more involved with the family over the late 19 teens, and Nehru in particular sees something in Gandhi, and Jawaharlal sees something in Gandhi and hopes to work closely with him. From Nan's perspective, that is Vijayalakshmi Pandit, she is more skeptical. She doesn't see Gandhi as radical in the right ways. She kind of sees him as a recalcitrant conservative. And this, and we might talk about this in a different moment in our conversation, but she has a love affair and he intervenes in this. And she really gets quite upset at him for his intervention. That takes us until 1919. And it's right at that point that the great pivot occurs. Gandhi launches his first major campaign, and a shift occurs from that point forward. He becomes kind of a luminous figure and like the important figure in the Indian national movement. It rises in stature. The Nehrus allowed him, and Nan gradually, over the course of the first few years of the 20s, comes to see great value in him. And over time, she ultimately draws very, very close to him and considers him basically a father figure towards the later parts of her life.
I want to emphasize, too, what is beautifully explained in your book, which is the transition of the Nehru family from this elite kind of anglicized Indian world to one that embraces the asceticism of the Mahatma.
So it's difficult to describe just how grand the Nehru lifestyle was. I mean, they had the finest china, the most beautiful silk rugs, the best of clothing, everything was top of the line. What Gandhi brings to everyone's attention is how much these kinds of things were at odds with the way most people in the subcontinent were living, and how in various ways they were also part and parcel of the oppression of the local population. So he convinces the elite to give up some of their privileges, and the Nehrus really adopt his posture as fully as possible. They clean out their home of many of their finest possessions, and they adopt, in lieu of their silks and other such kinds of clothing, they adopt the coarse homespun cotton material that Gandhi was famous for, lead what is in essence a Spartan lifestyle thereafter for the duration of the anti-colonial movement. I just add one point on this. I should just say that Nan was someone who was, she was still very young at this point in the 19 teens and 20s. And in that initial period, she was more questioning than some of her other family members of this decision. She went along with it much more reluctantly. Later on in her life, she laughed at her kind of naivete and innocence at those points. But she eventually went full in on the same position as the rest of her family, that is to say,
let's just run through, just because she's not a figure known to our audience, a few more details on her marriage and her feminine the development of her feminist consciousness. We've covered a little bit the development of both a class and racial consciousness. Tell us a little bit about Pandit, her husband, and other feminist role models or women role models she may have had at this time, beyond these very powerful male ones in her father, brother, and the Mahatma.
So there were several, the Nehru family had several extremely fierce activist women members, including Uma Nehru and Rameshwari Nehru. And so these two family members helped serve as early role models for Nan. And then there were two very popular political figures who did as well. Annie Besant, who was influential in the Congress and in the anti-colonial campaign, and Sarojini Naidu, known later or ultimately as the Nightingale of India. So these, Sarojini Naidu in particular, was famous for her writing, for her oratory, and her ability to be poetic in her language. All of these women, with their eloquence, the way they carried themselves, their absolutely determined posturing, their ability to hold their own in any debate, and their defense of principles, all of these things, I think, served as important foundational elements in Nan's growth. So I'd say she grew from those kinds of things. She ended up having what was an arranged marriage. Her family helped to introduce her to one of her brother's associates, a man named Ranjit Pandit. Ranjit Pandit was, a Renaissance man in many ways. He spoke multiple languages. He was himself a writer, but he was also a sportsman and an intellectual, an all-rounder, as we might think of it. Although they met at the family impetus, they spent some time together. Initially, they grew to be very, very deeply in love with one another, and everything that I found, every record, every letter, was just filled with kind of the deepest affection.
And shared this deep political conviction and commitment to the independence of India. He was deeply involved as well. Let's move back into that history a little bit. But before we do, I do want to emphasize again, since it's International Women's Day, that the degree to which your book, in the most intimate way and compelling way, explains the role that women played in this enormous, important transition in India's history. Today it's a given that people who are interested in development and in human rights ought to invest in women. It was not a given then, and yet the All India Women's Conference, which Nan headed and for at this time for a brief time, was so critical, I think, to bringing about an understanding of why India had to move forward on its own, and why colonialism could no longer be sustained. Tell us a little bit about that. And I, of course, I would like you to add a brief shout out to Margaret Sanger, about whom I wrote a biography now more than three decades ago, but happily it's still in print. And given the current cancel culture and some of the concerns that people have today about Sanger and about birth control as an instrument of social control, tell us about how Nan understood it and welcomed Sanger and other feminists at the time in the 1930s, particularly to India, because of their shared commitment to women's rights and to birth control as tools of social and economic and cultural uplift.
Right. So let's see. Margaret Sanger is the leading advocate of birth control in the United States. And she is particularly interested in bringing some of her ideas to India. But to be clear, she sees India as a place that already is having conversations around birth control. So she's very cautious about coming across as an imperialist. She also wants to learn from what they're doing and what they might be doing right. So one of the things that she's also interested in is how some other people in the subcontinent are talking about things. And she's also concerned maybe about what Gandhi's positions on all of these things are. So
explain that a little bit, because I think for our audience, it's a fantastic insight into history. Gandhi was an ascetic, and he believed, as I understand it, that Indians should husband their sexual energies and apply them to politics. And Margaret Sanger, in a very famous confrontation with Gandhi, tries to convince him that that's not a very realistic posture, right?
Right. So, well, Gandhi had all kinds of quirky issues, quirky views on sex. And in fact, this is one of the areas where Nan strongly disagreed with the Mahatma, I mean, right from the time she was young. So basically, yes, exactly. He believed, so let's start with what Gandhi believed. Gandhi believed that, especially for him, if you could marshal your sexual, harness your sexual energies by restraint, by withholding, then you increase your spiritual power. And a lot of his political philosophy was based on restraint and on keeping yourself and bad impulses in check. And he saw sex as something that was functional. You know, you did it only for procreation and not for really much else. And even then, you know, it was a very kind of regressive attitude towards the whole thing. It also was something that even many of his closest followers had a very difficult time actually following. So I think Sanger's whole view on this and many other people surrounding him was always like, well, you know, you can do it because you can be like this saint-like person if you wish to be, but it's hard for everyone else, and therefore it's unrealistic to base kinds of policies on these kinds of attitudes. At any rate, Margaret Sanger was really keen to talk about birth control and was excited that some people in India outside of Gandhi were talking about this as well. So in 1935, she plans this trip to India. She coordinates this with a British suffragette named Edith Howe Martin and with an Irish, also suffragette, and peace activist named Margaret Cousins, who had helped establish the All India Women's Conference. Sanger makes her way to India, and she is pleased. Actually, she meets Nehru along the way and is stunned by him. When she meets Gandhi, she's actually quite surprised because he has a kind of immediate effect on her, and she sees, she describes this in a kind of funny way, that he has this light inside of him. But she, you know, she works with the All India Women's Conference, and she pushes forward with some of her ideas, and she makes connections with various kinds of people. And she also connects with Nan while she's there. Nan is involved with the All India Women's Conference, although in mind ways.
To try to wrap this up, because I don't want to spend too much time on it, I do want to just, for an American audience, point out that what your book suggests is the opposite of a notion that somehow this is an interest, a sort of culturally imperialistic intent and an interest in suppressing the population of India. It is, she's very much committed, Sanger, that is, along with the Nehrus, to Indian independence, and sees birth control as one of a toolkit, many tools that will be needed to make the transition from poverty to economic development. It's a wonderful story and one of the many that you tell so beautifully in the book. Let's quickly, though, because I need to be mindful of time here. We only have 15 more minutes or so. Move back in a historical context. We're talking about the 1930s now, and this is still a relatively peaceful time in India, the situation for the neighbors and Gandhi becomes much more complicated with the when World War II occurs. The British become more concerned about holding on to their colonies. Politics becomes much more complicated. Talk a little bit about what happens to Nan in that period and the great sacrifices that she and her brother must make, and her husband as well, for their commitment to independence, a jail term, separation from their three children. There were three daughters by this time, compromises to their health, and ultimately the premature death of Rajiv Pandit.
Right. So the main thing is that all of the family members, Jawaharlal, Ranjit, and Nan, as well as sometimes even her eldest child, Nehru's eldest daughter, Indira, and other members of the family as well, face prison terms for their various activities related to the anti-colonial campaigns. Nan was arrested and served three prison terms, the third being the lengthiest one of all. Ranjit Pandit also suffers prison terms, and these things I describe in the book. I go into a fair amount of detail about the conditions in these prisons. You know, they're eating very poor kinds of food. The weather isn't very good. The rain sometimes falls directly on their head. There are, you know, huge clouds of mosquitoes. A bat falls on one of their chests at one point in the middle of the night. I mean, all kinds of things happen while they're in prison. So the conditions are not the greatest in the world. In various prisons, the conditions are even much worse than I just described. So this takes a toll on everyone's health. They suffer from various kinds of ailments because of it. It also obviously has impacts on mental health. And the person who it takes the greatest toll on, however, is Nan's husband, Ranjit Pandit, who develops a serious kind of condition from being exposed to all of these kinds of things. And the family is insistent that they don't really try to get special treatment for the most part. And so ultimately, the net result of everything is that Ranjit Pandit dies essentially as a result of these prison terms. And so it's a pretty heavy toll. The other aspect of all of this, as you already mentioned in your question, Ranjit and Nan have three children, three young children, and in particular, a very young daughter. And Nan worries, as any mother would, about such long separations. And she feels terrible for the mental toll this is taking on her young children, this idea that their parents can be snatched away from them in the middle of the night, the feelings of anxiety, the feelings of impermanence, you know, all of this stuff. That also she bears a guilt for the path that she and her husband chose at the expense of their children and their family. For the children's part, they were all very strong, it turned out. They all three girls grew into extraordinary women in their own right. And the middle one, Nayanthara Sehgal, Nayanthara Pandit, who goes on to become Nayanthara Sehgal, has emerged as one of India's most celebrated writers. She, in particular, wrote about some of these episodes, and one of them was always very generous to her mother.
Honestly, I'm thinking of a quote from Kai Bird, who today was awarded a major prize in biography. You know, among his many books is the biography of that you mentioned, of Oppenheimer, on which the film is based. He talks about how biography is an intimate and accessible way to understand history. And I mean, just listening to you, but also having read the book, it's a kind of a page turner in this respect, and a wonderful series of insights into this extraordinary century in Indian history and in the history of you know, of colonialism and of its downfall and of emerging, you know, Southern, a world, you know, of enormous potential that is finally being realized today in a reordered global context. But unfortunately, we have to move on. So let's talk a little bit about that, how World War II, you know, ultimately produces a situation where colonialism can no longer be tolerated, where human rights and democracy are advanced, where the British are willing to make their peace with an independent India. But let's talk about all this in terms of ideology, since we are both historians, trained historians, not just about individuals and personalities, although another aspect of your book is to show how powerful leadership or individuals are in how history proceeds. You know, we're taught in graduate school to look at large social and economic and cultural factors, but, you know, the more I wrote biography, the more I thought that people make a big difference. Individuals do make a big difference in how things turn out. But let's talk about the ideologies that the Nehrus and Gandhi too, before his assassination, embraced to sort of shape modern India. You also discuss them beautifully in the book. Non-aligned democratic socialism, one worldism, anti-racism. Tell us a little bit about this.
They were influenced by Fabian socialists like George Bernard Shaw and others, oftentimes interacted or met them and admired some of their ideas. They ultimately developed their kind of own view of things, but they, I say, remain committed to some of the foundational principles of Fabian socialism. The other thing that they were staunchly true to from the outset was that they were anti-fascist. From the very earliest point on, both Jawaharlal and Vijayalakshmi Pandit spent their time expressing their views that warn of the dangers of rising fascism and were very critical of policies that basically appeased fascist actions. And they also, in particular, did not think highly of the individuals associated with fascism. So I'd say that's an important element as well. One worldism for the Nehrus was a stand-in for this belief of a ultimately a goal of world federation, which would allow for a lot of autonomy of different states, and would allow for the drawing of elements of Eastern cultures and societies that were extremely valuable and important, together with elements from Western traditions that were equally important and valuable, to create kind of this holistic view of how the world could operate together. In a sense, it was very idealistic. Well, it was very idealistic, but Vijayalakshmi Pandit in particular meshed that together with, a hardcore realism as well. That is, she always saw things on the ground and tried to operate on in the way that those, you know, whatever the local issues were at the time. And she also made a distinction between, well, these are very nice things to say in the abstract, but what does it mean when we deal with this, that, or the other problem, and we need more concrete guidance? So I'd say that those are all very important elements. The last one, which you also mentioned, was that she was a committed anti-racist, that was also a consistent position that she held in all of the different activities with which she participated, and which only got stronger from her first American tour over 1944 and 1945 forward. And she, for example, was kind of the lead figure in criticizing South Africa right from the get-go on discriminatory policies. And that evolved by the 1960s into one of the first sustained critiques of apartheid.
And that's a formative influence in the early years of the UN, because she believed so deeply, as did her brother, in the foundational principles of the UN, which you have just articulated. Unfortunately, we're running out of time. We just have five more minutes at most left. Let me just say that what you described today in our interview, but in much more detail in the book, is that this was a woman who was obviously the sister of a very important figure. But in her own right, she begins to serve India as a diplomat after World War II because she has the essential requisite skills of being a good diplomat. She's fiercely intelligent, well-educated, speaks several languages, has a moral core, and incredible political and social savvy. She's charming, but she's also very, very tough and wily in her understanding of politics. This produces inevitable tensions with some of her brother's professional subordinates. I mean, she is, after all, the beloved younger sister, as well as this very talented woman. But let's wrap up just by talking about what happens to her and what she does in the years after World War II. We won't really be able to get into her older years and her relationship with Indira Gandhi, but we need to leave something for people who want to read the book. So talk a little bit about that, but we just have about 2 minutes.
Well, in the immediate aftermath of World War II, she goes on to become one of the most celebrated Indians in the world. She's thought of, according to Walter White, the secretary of the NAACP, as one of the two greatest women in the world, along with Eleanor Roosevelt. She has a whole host of accolades. She's consistently on the Gallup poll. Many people...
She's also in the Soviet Union at an astonishing moment, the story you tell from there is astonishing. And then India's represented to the British, to Britain, and then to the United States, and then to the UN. I mean, she has very, very significant professional experience.
Yes, exactly. She's all over the place, and she just rises to this kind of unique position where she's loved, as you just said, across the board. She isn't entirely successful. She acknowledges that in the Soviet Union, but she does have a good rapport with people like Vyshinsky and others there. She has a very good relationship with Alexander Kollontai, for example, which, by the way, one of the people who was responsible for Women's Day in the Soviet Union. So she has a very good relationship across the board. Ultimately, the main contest that she has in this period is she develops friction with a competitor named Krishna Menon, and he eventually ices her out in the 1950s as an important figure. And she's on the margins for a period of time. It takes a long time for her to finally win the battle against him. But she does outmaneuver him in the end.
Well, again, and her brother sends her to the UN, where she becomes the first woman to serve as president of the UN General Assembly, which is no small matter at a time when the UN is finding its feet. I mean, still a relatively small organization by comparison today. This is before countries in the global south are given their independence and joined, but she's part of what is a very, very complicated and interesting history of in the articulation of human rights and of women's rights as human rights, and of the many models for development that we've been having to contend with, many of them not successful, some of them more so. Just 2 minutes concluding. Do you have any criticisms of her? Your book is most affectionate, but it's not hagiography.
Right. I mean, I think this was important to me, and it was actually important to some of the people I interviewed, which is, I think hagiography falls short in many ways and then ultimately besmirches any other attempt of whatever such work is intended to do. So yes, she had her failures. She sometimes made wrong choices. She sometimes rubbed people the wrong way. People criticized her for choices she made in terms of her spendings. People criticized her for some of her, like the displays that she made. People criticized her in the Soviet Union for not being entirely effective or meeting with Stalin. So those were some of the kinds of things. And obviously people on the left, like Krishna Menon, criticized her or kind of pushed her aside. Many men criticized her for being not serious enough. I don't think that's a fair criticism at all. And I hope I undermine that in the book. I think she faced a number of challenges. I think the biggest one of all, though, is that she faced a number of personal health and mental health challenges in her life. And I think that's not a criticism of her. It's just a reality of some of the stress and challenges that she faced during her life. And it's a testament to what it takes and the toll it can take to lead the kind of life that she did, to break the barriers that she did. I try to deal with that as openly and as transparently as I can, because I think breaking the silence on those kinds of things to understand that people that are extraordinary also go through these things, I think will help us to have a much more fruitful conversation about issues like mental health and the prevalence that they in which such things exist in our society.
This is a wonderful way, I think, to end this terrific interview. Thank you so much, Manu. I love the way you end the preface to your book as well by talking about how in the most famous picture of Gandhi and Nehru, a kind of one that's been used over and over and over again, two jocular men talking, she was actually cut out. It was actually a photograph of the three of them. But you have managed to restore her to the frame and to also alter the possible meaning of the relationship between the two men, because this woman was really a third important dimension of that relationship, part of a wonderful world that is, you know, lost to so many people, but that you've happily restored. I want to thank you again for sharing your insights. Look for the book, which has been, as I said, a bestseller in India, will hopefully be published in the future here in the United States, or available in the United States soon. My thanks as well to Hristo Voynev for his technical assistance on this broadcast. I also want to acknowledge Duncan McKay for sharing the song International of Horizons for the theme music for this little series. I'm Ellen Chesler again, sitting in for John Torpy, saying thanks for joining us. And we look forward to having you with us for the next episode of International Horizons.